You're listening to the Throwback Podcast, your one stop for exclusive interviews and talk of everything 90s with a little 80s and 2000s mixed in with your host, Ryan the Podman, Rafiq. The following is a throwback exclusive.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Throwback Podcast. This is your host, Ryan the Podman.
And me, Daddy, Jimmy the Radio Man, Daddy.
We have another good show lined up for you guys, especially if you're a fan of the world of professional wrestling. Our special guest on this edition is the former president. I said president, right, Jimmy?
Oh, yeah, you did, Daddy.
Okay, good. Yeah. Our former guest is the former president of World Championship Wrestling and WWE Hall of Famer, Eric Bischoff.
All right, I'm waiting for this, Daddy. Easy. Baby.
Eric Bischoff stops by the podcast to talk about to us about how he got started in the world of professional wrestling, his experience of being the president of WCW, and also about his new book that's coming out called Grateful. I think you guys will really enjoy this interview. Hey, Jimmy, I see you got a package on the table.
Yeah, baby, let me tell you now, this is special delivery. It just came in the mail this morning. I ordered a brand new NWO t-shirt once I found out my main man, Eazy-E, Eric Bischoff, is coming on.
Oh, nice. Open it up.
Yeah, open it up right now.
Man, those NWO t-shirts are iconic. Actually, the NWO is iconic, period. Along with Sting, Goldberg, DDP, Lex Luger, the Cruiserweights, WCW in general.
Doug Dillinger. Don't forget about Doug Dillinger, Daddy.
Doug Dillinger? Okay. You mean the head of WCW security? He wasn't even a wrestler, Jimmy.
Yeah, he always maintained law and order and justice. Those of you had him lay down the law, Daddy. Sting didn't want a piece of Doug Dillinger. Why do you think Sting was hiding in the rafters all that time?
And then, Jimmy, just finish opening your package. Anyway, folks, I think you'll really enjoy this interview. We did not even begin to touch the surface on what we could have talked about, but this interview reflects and covers more on Eric's start in the business, his early days running WCW, and his new book that's coming out that sounds like it's a must-read. Like always, if you like what you hear today, be sure to check us out on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Amazon, and wherever else you listen to your favorite podcast. And also be sure to follow us on Twitter at ThrowPodcast and on Instagram at Throwback_podcast for more.
Oh, no, Daddy.
Jimmy, what's wrong?
It should be the wrong item. This was supposed to be an NWO t-shirt.
What did you end up getting?
They sent me a Polly Pocket playset, Daddy.
What? In the world did you get that instead of a t-shirt?
I don't know, Daddy. I will not stand for this, Dad. Let me tell you something. I made a special announcement to make about after this interview for the folks at eBay.
Oh, boy. Looking forward to that. Anyways, folks, enjoy the interview. So how did you first get into the wrestling business? You first worked with the AWA, correct?
Correct.
How'd you get involved with the AWA?
You know, it was really just coincidence to a degree. I had a meeting with Vern Gagne about something not necessarily related to me in the wrestling business. I had a product that I wanted to advertise on his wrestling show. So we had a meeting and everybody kind of hit it off. And a couple of days after that meeting, I got a phone call and they offered me a job.
Nice. So how was it like working for Vern Gagne and AWA? Like how long were you working with them for?
Oh, that lasted from about 87 to 91. And it was, especially the first couple of years, it was fantastic. You know, I having grown up being a wrestling fan, and at this point, you know, I was in my late 20s or early 30s, so I'd kind of grown out of my fandom, but certainly grew up as a teenager and a young adult watching Vern Gagne and, you know, Wahoo McDaniel and Ray Stevens and Nick Bockwinkel and all those guys. And now here I am working with them. So you can only imagine how much fun that was.
So how did you like your time in AWA? Did you enjoy it a lot?
I enjoy it immensely. It's still, in many respects, probably, I don't know if I would say the fondest part of my career, but I look at that period of time very, very fondly, and I'm very grateful for it because it, you know, obviously introduced me to the business of the wrestling business and was my first, you know, foot in the door, which ended up being kind of an interesting journey. So, yeah, I'm very grateful for it.
Nice. Before going to WCW, didn't you have an audition with the WWF as an announcer?
Yeah, about 1990, 91. I can't remember when it was, but I think it was 1990. Vern had been, you know, financially struggling quite a bit. He was in a pretty intense lawsuit with the state of Minnesota, who was trying to take his property. Vern had worked, you know, his whole life and was very successful. And he built what he thought was his final home, a big, beautiful piece of property on a lake. And the state of Minnesota decided they wanted to have that property as a park. So they enforced a legal theory or law called eminent domain. And we're basically trying to force Vern off his property. And Vern he fought that. And in the process of fighting, you know, the state in a lawsuit, Vern was tapped out. And I worked for Vern for probably 6 months, 4 months, 6 months, something like that, maybe a little longer, without getting paid, just because he no longer had the money. And around that same time, WWF at the time, WWE now, I had an ad in the paper in the Minneapolis Star Tribune that they were looking for an announcer. And I found a way to make an application. And next thing I knew, I was on a plane and getting flown out to Stamford, Connecticut to audition.
How do you think you did in the audition?
Oh, I sucked. I wouldn't have hired me either.
Yeah. So how did you end up in WCW? Like, what brought you to WCW?
Well, as I mentioned, I had, you know, was suffering financially because I wasn't getting paid, and I was loyal to Vern. And I also knew that if I got out of the wrestling business and went off and did something else, likely I wouldn't be able to get back in the business.
Right.
So I was, and maybe that's just what I told myself. I don't know, but I stuck it out and got to the point where I couldn't stick it out any longer. And Larry Zbyszko, who I worked with in the AWA, who was actually married to one of Vern's daughters, had moved down to WCW for the same reason. He couldn't afford to work for Vern anymore because Vern wasn't paying anybody. And Larry was down there, and I got wind through Larry Zbyszko, I think, that WCW was hiring and they were looking for announcers. So same thing, man. I just put together a demo tape and shipped it down to Jim Herd, and I'm on a plane a couple days later and auditioning.
Wow. So you pretty much got the job right away after you auditioned?
Yeah, the same day.
Same day. Cool. So when you first arrived to WCW, what was your first impressions overall? Did you like the environment originally?
Oh, it was amazing, man. Come on. I came from a small regional territory that was going broke. And now I'm walking into the CNN Center, where WCW offices exist, along with CNN and TNT Network and the TBS Network. And, you know, it's like going from, you know, Little League Baseball to, you know, final game of the World Series.
Right.
It was that much difference. Of course, you know, everything was bigger and it was better funded. And for the first 6 months or a year, man, I was just in awe of it all. And, you know, I didn't live in Atlanta. They only flew me in. They flew me in once a week, and I'd work, you know, maybe one day or 2 days, and then they'd fly me home. So it wasn't like I was spending a lot of time there. So each time I, you know, got to Atlanta, and I was staying at the Omni Hotel right at the CNN Center, and I'd come in the night before and just kind of walk around in the atrium and just soak it all in, man. It was cool.
Wow. So what was your first event you appeared on? I can't remember. Was it Halloween Havoc?
No, well, the first pay-per-view, I don't know, man. I don't remember. It might have been Halloween Havoc. What might have been the first pay-per-view, I'm not sure. Likely would have been War Games, too. I don't know, man. I can't remember.
Yeah, I know. It's so long.
It's 100 years ago, man. I don't know.
So how did you end up from becoming an announcer to the executive vice president of the company? That's like a giant step.
It started out, basically, Ted Turner hired a guy by the name of Bill Shaw. He assigned Bill. Bill Shaw was the vice president of human resources at Turner Broadcasting. He worked right under Ted. He reported directly to Ted. And Ted wanted Bill Shaw to take over WCW. And there's a lot of reasons why that made sense from a human resources perspective, because there were a lot of things wrong with WCW HR-wise.
Right.
So Bill came in and he said, look, Ted wants to make some changes and we're going to hire an executive producer someone from the television industry, not necessarily somebody from the wrestling industry, but somebody from the television industry,
right?
Because this is a television product and we want it to be operated like a television company.
Right.
And I thought, okay, well, I'm kind of a wrestling guy, but not really. I've only got a couple of years of experience, but I also have a lot of ideas and basic understanding of television. And I, at the time, I was already pitching ideas and shows out in Hollywood. So I had kind of already planned on leaving WCW anyway. I'd already sold a kids show to a Fox Children's Network back when they had one. So I thought, hell with it, man. I'm going to hang up my suit, so to speak, in the wrestling business, and I'm going to go out to LA and pitch TV shows. Well, around that same time, Bill Shaw came in, said that they were looking for an executive producer, and I thought, what the hell? I'll throw my name in the hat and see what happens. And ended up getting the job as executive producer. Shortly after that, I was a vice president, then senior vice president, then an executive vice president, and ultimately a president.
So I was kind of right at the beginning. You were executive vice president, then you
moved I was also a C-Squad announcer, but you don't introduce me that way, numbnuts. Come on, man.
What was your favorite part of being executive vice president? Like, on your first day, what was your first day like?
Oh, I don't remember, man.
Okay, overall, what was your favorite part about being the president?
It's nice to be in a position where you can execute your vision or your ideas without having to jump through a lot of hoops to do it. Right. And fortunately, I had a lot of latitude. I was given pretty much free rein to a degree, not totally free rein, but
right.
For all intents and purposes, practical purposes, free rein. And I really enjoyed that. And it made for a much more creative environment, not just for me, but for everybody.
Everybody, right.
Because, you didn't have two or three layers above you second guessing you, especially when there are people that are working above you that don't know anything about the business you're in second guessing you. That gets real tiresome. So that part of it was fun. I liked that.
Did you have a least favorite part of the job you didn't like too much?
You know, I can't pick one thing. I think dealing with idiots, you know, there's so many idiots at the executive level in a corporate environment. I mean, there's some very talented people, very, very talented people, but there are too many people, at least back then, that were in positions of management, but they didn't really understand the business that they were managing.
Right.
And that dealing with people like that, really, that was tiresome.
No, I can see that. Yeah. I think your first really big splash as became vice president was signing Hulk Hogan. Like, did it take a lot of how was that process? Was it like a long process to convince him to sign with WCW?
No, I think we probably spent about 2 or 3 weeks talking and dancing and having beers and all that kind of stuff until finally the attorneys got involved, and that probably took another couple months, but we knew we were going to do a deal. It just takes, sometimes contracts take a long time.
No, I get. Yeah. It's a process. I think day-to-day you did maybe 6 or 8 pay-per-views a year. Then when you took over and went from,
they were doing 4 pay-per-views a year when I took over. And I was the one that increased the number of pay-per-views.
Yeah.
Because it was the only revenue that WCW was generating. They weren't generating any money. We weren't getting a television license fee like WWE does or AEW does. We weren't getting that. We were just producing the show. Our live event business was losing money. We didn't really have any licensing and merchandising that amounted to much. So the only real revenue that we could create that didn't already exist was by adding pay-per-views, because the profit margin on a pay-per-view is quite high.
Right.
So I went from 4 to 6, 6 to 8, 8 to 10, and 10 to 12.
Right. Yeah, WCW, I think, was doing monthly pay-per-views before WWF was doing it.
We did a lot of things before WWF.
I know that. I was going to ask you, too, about the pay-per-views. In your opinion, what was WCW's flagship pay-per-view? I always thought, you know how WWE has WrestleMania, right? I always thought Starrcade was the flagship. But, some years, I noticed, pay-per-views like Super Brawl and Halloween Havoc had bigger bills than even Starrcade had. So did you have, in your mind, a flagship event of WCW?
In my mind, Halloween Havoc was the flagship event. You know, Starrcade was before I even got to WCW. That was, I think, that was the intention of creating, Starrcade was going to be WCW's version of WrestleMania, and that's why they treated it the way they treated it. That all happened before I got there, so I kind of inherited that Starcade is our, you know, premier event mentality. But it didn't take me long once I got into management to realize that the Starcade pay-per-view, because it happens over Christmas,
right,
was really not performing all that well. Because of Christmas holidays, nobody's watching television. Everybody's out doing stuff. Everybody's spending money on Christmas stuff. And pay-per-view is kind of like not that big of a deal on the list, right? Over the holidays. So I quickly, you know, after analyzing the trends for 2 or 3 years with Starcade versus the other pay-per-views, I thought, well, wait a minute. Let's get the consumers buy-in before the holiday season. Because there's more discretionary money out there in the marketplace. Once the holiday season hits, that discretionary money kind of dries up. So that was my reason for positioning Halloween Havoc, at least under my watch, as the premier event and not Starcade.
Right. No, I can see that, because I noticed a lot of your Halloween Havoc had a bigger build than Starcade. Do you have a particular favorite Halloween Havoc that you promoted?
There were several, you know, 96, 97, probably even 98. You know, we had a run of about 3 really good Halloween Havocs that were all, you know, record breakers and great shows and a lot of fun. And it's in Las Vegas. So after all the hard work, you get to have a little bit of hard fun. So it was cool.
That's all right. Yeah, I agree. Now, how did the creation of Day to Day Nitro take place? It took place in a meeting with I think you had a meeting with Ted Turner, correct? It was like a meeting room.
Yeah, I had a meeting with Ted scheduled. It had nothing to do with adding another television show. And in the very beginning of that meeting, I think Ted asked me a question and I answered the question. And then he said, hey, Eric, what's it going to take for WCW to compete with WWE? And, you know, I wasn't prepared for that question, but the only real honest answer was WWE is Monday nights in prime time, and WCW at that time was 6:05 Eastern on Saturday, 3:05 Eastern on the West Coast. I said, we'll never be able to compete with a Saturday evening time slot against Monday night prime time. Right. And that's when Ted looked over at Scott Sass and said, okay, give Eric 2 hours every night on Monday night. And wow. Then I had prime time. That was how it happened. That's almost word cool. for word.
Wow. WCW Nitro is actually a pretty cool name. Were there ever any other names considered for the show before Nitro? Do you recall?
No. Brad Siegel, who was the president of TNT at that time, it was really his idea, but he wanted to do it because TNT already had what they called the Nitro block. Now, a block in television programming language is basically like a 3-hour window in primetime where you have 3 sitcoms in a row or right. 4 or 6 or whatever, right? It's your sitcom block. In the case of TNT, I think it was on Tuesday nights, they had Tuesday Night Nitro.
Right.
And that Nitro block was really all action films, you know, Jean-Claude Van Damme, Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know, you name it, you know, Chuck Norris films, all that kind of horseshit. That was their action block that he called Nitro. And since we were going to be on Monday nights, it was Brad Siegel's idea and desire to call it Monday Nitro. And I love the idea. I thought it was fantastic.
Right. Yeah. I remember the first Nitro. Whose idea was it to have the first Nitro at the Mall of America? I thought that was pretty cool.
That was mine. I lived in Minneapolis for a long time. So I was very familiar with the Mall of America because it was really new at that time. Mall of America, I think it had only been open for maybe a year at that point. I'm not sure. I have to go back and look. But it was relatively new, and I'd been in there once or twice visiting, and I was just so impressed with it. I knew it had that big atrium. But the reason I wanted to go there was because WCW at that time, we just couldn't draw a house.
Right.
You know, we just couldn't get people to our TV tapings because it was just such a soft product. It just wasn't working. So I wanted to go to someplace. I wanted to shoot the show someplace that was cool. It had a really cool look and vibe to it, but wouldn't require me putting 5,000 people in an arena because I knew we couldn't draw them.
Now, you know, I love the early days of the Nitro announce team with you, Bobby Heenan, and Steve McMichael. Now, whose idea was it to bring in Steve McMichael? I absolutely loved him on commentary when he was there.
You know, I just found out because I never knew. I couldn't remember. I said, God, did I seek out Steve McMichael or did he come to me? Or I couldn't remember. And I asked Jeff Jarrett a couple months ago. And Jeff goes, oh, no. I talked to Steve about that. And it was Harvey Schiller, who was my boss. Right. Harvey Schiller was the president of TBS Sports. And obviously, is, you know, because of his role in TBS Sports, he had a lot of relationships in the NFL because Ted Turner owned the NFL rights for cable at that time.
Right.
So it was Harvey Schiller who met Steve McMichael somewhere. And Harvey came to me and said, hey, I met this guy, Steve McMichael, Chicago Bear. And I knew who Steve was. I knew him very well because he was playing against the Vikings back then.
Right.
And I said, oh, man, I know who he is. It'd be great. So try him out, see if it'll work. And I did. And we just got along great and had a blast doing it.
Was there anyone else ever considered for his role before he was brought in? Do you recall anyone?
No, because we didn't really need a third person. We brought Steve in because we knew he'd give us instant credibility. And Steve is a very entertaining guy. You know,
yeah, he's very funny.
He's not Jim Ross when it comes to calling a match and doing color commentary, but he was entertaining as hell. And he was Steve freaking McMichael. He has credibility. You know what I mean? He did a lot on the field, and that carried over to a certain part of the audience. Some of the wrestling audience didn't care or whatever, but to advertisers, to mainstream media that covers us or that we wanted to cover us, to morning DJs around the country that are talking about it on their morning drive shows, all of that was added value that Steve brought that very few people could. That's why we brought him in.
That's good. I know the story's been told a lot, but how did the creation of the NWO come about? I believe, didn't you say you were inspired by, I think, an angle in Japan or New Japan?
No, that's what the dirt sheet said. The dirt sheet said that. Now, I had been going back and forth to Japan quite a bit and kind of, I don't want to say studying because that makes it sound a little more formal than it was, but paying attention to what worked in Japan, because in Japan at the time, they were selling out everywhere. They had their one big show a year. They put 80,000 people in a Tokyo Dome.
Right.
They were, and here in the States, WWE, their live event business was in a toilet, and WCW's was worse. So I wanted to figure out what the Japanese were doing that we weren't, and to see if any of that would, you know, you could translate, because culturally, Japan and the United States are so different.
Right.
Not everything, you know, imports well. But one of the things that I noticed is that in Japan, professional wrestling was treated more like a legitimate sport, not only by the producers and the performers, but also by mainstream media and the culture. Here in the States at that time, it was Doink the Clown and, IRS agent, you know, Isaac Yankum, you know, there was just like animated cartoonish. yeah, all that cartoony kind of kiddie shit. Whereas in Japan, everything was very legitimate and believable, and it was treated that way, and it was treated with respect. Right. So I thought, man, if there's some way, someday I can figure out a way to create a story that brings that sense of reality that I was seeing in Japan, seeing that sense of reality and credibility to a story, that'd probably be pretty good. And that's where it started. You know, it was really going to Japan and seeing that sense of reality and authenticity and respect in the presentation and trying to figure out a way to bring it here. And after, I don't know, a year or two of thinking about it and kind of sketching out ideas in my head, Scott Hall calls and now he's available. Kevin Nash is available. And all of a sudden now I've got an invasion angle that I can put together that feels very real. But I didn't see an invasion angle in Japan. I didn't follow the storylines in Japan. You know, I'd go over there once or twice a year and watch an event. And then the rest of the time I was in a sushi bar or out to eat with some of the executives at New Japan Pro Wrestling.
And
we're talking about creative.
So tell us a little bit about your book.
Well, the book is called Grateful. It's available as of right now. Today is October 24th on pre-sale. All you need to do is go to bischoffbook.com. The book is called Grateful, and it covers really my life from about 2006 or 7 to present day. So it kind of picks up right where my last book left off, to be honest with you.
Right.
Controversy creates cash kind of covered my my life in the business from day one all the way up until about 2006. And this book picks up about 2007 to present day. And it's really, it's about wrestling. Wrestling is the backdrop and my experiences in WWE as a talent and TNA and WWE as an executive for a minute and everything that I've gone through in between, as well as a lot of other projects that I've worked on in addition to wrestling. But at the end of it all, it's just, you know, about how I became grateful for my career and how much more it means to me today than it even did while I was doing it. Right. Because I have a whole different perspective on life in general, but also, you know, as a part of that on my career. And it took a while to be grateful because I was carrying around, you know, I was carrying around a little bit of baggage and I was angry and about some things or at some people. And, you know, it's, well, that's a stupid way to live. You know, it's like, man, just focus on all the good stuff that it created and forget about all that bad shit. And once I started thinking about it like that, I really have begun to enjoy, you know, looking back at my career. Whereas in the past, I didn't want to talk about it. Like, move on.
Man, you have
the book is called Grateful. It's available, like I said, right now, bushhuffbook.com. It comes out. You'll be able to get it at Amazon on November 11th. But if you order it now, you'll get an autographed copy.
Oh, nice. Okay, so it was a pleasure having you on, Eric. You're like one of my favorites of all time. Like, I'm a big, huge JCW fan. Thanks for coming on the show. Any last words before you leave?
No, Ryan, I appreciate the invitation. I love doing this kind of stuff with guys like you that are up and coming and trying to break into the world of podcasting. So thank you very much for the opportunity.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right, buddy. Be well.
All right, you too.
I would like to take this time to thank the former president of WCW and WWE Hall of Famer, Eric Bischoff, for stopping by the podcast to talk with us. His book, Grateful, comes out on November 11th. You can pre-order the book online at bischoffbook.com. It seems like it'll be a great read. Also, be sure to check out his podcast, 83 Weeks. New episodes come every Monday that goes more in depth about his career and time being the president of WCW. Like I said, there was so much we could have talked about with Eric Bischoff and his legendary career. It's hard to just narrow it down, but it was great to hear about his start in professional wrestling and how he got his start in WCW and eventually running a company that was the greatest competitor the WWE, WWF has ever seen. Wouldn't you agree, Jimmy? Jimmy, oh wait, didn't he say something about a special announcement about that package mix-up?
The following announcements have been recorded by Jimmy the Radio Man. You folks at eBay Customer Service, let me tell you something now, Daddy. Answer the phone. You can do it. It's easy, Daddy. About as easy as messing up my order. This is no game, baby. This is reality. Reality is, I did not order this while the play set. Answer the phone, Daddy. Take this order back, Daddy. Do something that every customer wants you to do when you screw up. Hit the refund button. You have the guts to reply back? I know, I do, baby. Don't do the one thing you always seem to do. That is scam people, Daddy. Hey, support. Do you have the guts to reply? Oh, Jimmy here will be waiting for you with open arms. The receiving announcement is probably us by Jimmy the Radio Man.
Wow. What in the world did I just see?
I'm laying down the law on eBay, Daddy.
Just like your boy Doug Dillinger, right?
Damn right, Daddy.
You know, Jimmy, I think next time you should be more careful and pay attention to what you're doing.
What do you mean?
Well, while you're doing your little special announcement thing there, the delivery man came and brought your package. He said you were in such a rush this morning that you yanked the package out of his hand, the wrong package out of his hand.
So that is my NWO t-shirt in there?
I'm afraid so. He wanted the other package back too, but once I said you threw it out the window, he said don't bother.
Well, at least I have my NWO shirt now. Let me open it. Wait, I'm gonna delete that picture I sent to the email customer support. I'll be right back.
Wait, what picture? You know what? Never mind. I'm afraid to ask. Anyway, folks, we hope you enjoyed this episode of the Throwback Podcast. We have more great episodes on the way. Please stay tuned.
Wait a minute, Daddy. This is an LWO t-shirt.
Goodbye, everybody.
are listening to the Throwback Podcast, your one stop for exclusive interviews and talk of everything 90s with a little 80s and 2000s mixed in with your host, Ryan the Podman, Rafiq. The following is a Throwback exclusive.